And then we had to carry it from there by hand, you know, by, after dark, down to wherever pitch we're putting it in, you see.
How'd you carry a shell?
You slung two shells together with a stick between the slings and slung them over your shoulder. If you carried a single shell by itself, where they weren't in slings, sometimes they came up loose, and we had to carry them single then. They were very, very hard on your shoulder, a 60-pounder shell, so we used to put a folded sandbag under your braces, so it's like a shoulder pad, otherwise your shoulder was very sore by the end of the spell. Mm-hmm. And the cartridge boxes, there were ten in a box. Each cartridge weighed 9 pounds 7 ounces plus the box, so you'd used to nearly 100 weights altogether, the metal lined box. And there were wire handles towards the top on each side at such a length that as you walked, the bottom edge of the box was catching on your ankle. Devilish thing. So we used to finally get two chaps to lift it on your shoulder like that and hold it, sling that, and carry it on your shoulder, on your back, you see, down there, and then drop them off.
Mm. Now, as you were stockpiling this ammo in preparation for the Somme battle, how did you deal with the problem of storing so much of it?
Put it in these holes, all the way around.
Okay.
Some was at the roadside. We left it at the roadside. You have to bring it down other nights, you see.
Would you, on arriving at a new site for your gun, would you dig the gun in? To what extent would you dig the gun in?
Dependent on what sort of cover you had. Normally, you didn't dig them in. Only the trail was dug in. So the spade of the gun had something solid to butt against, you see. Also, you dug the trail in so to get a greater elevation, you see. Normally, your range was 13,500. And at about with a 2CRH shell, that was, two-calibre radius head. Do you follow what I mean? The curvature on the nose of the shell was equivalent to a circle of two calibres. In other words, with a 2CRH shell, that was, two-calibre radius head. Do you follow what I mean? The curvature on the nose of the shell was equivalent to a circle of two calibres, in other words, 10-inch, you see. Mm-hmm. Well, then we got some later shells, which are 8CRH, which they call them Roses Cordialis. They were...
Roses what?
Roses Cordialis. You know those lime juice cordial bottles?
Oh, yeah.
Like that. And the taper was very much steeper. And if we dug in so that we could get 35 degrees elevation, we could reach 15,000 yards with those, but they were not as accurate as the other shells at a shorter range.
Mm. Well, there were different techniques then for using the different kinds of ammunition you'd be firing. Tell me what kind of techniques you'd use for what kind of ammunition. I mean, take common shell, for example. What was common shell and how would you...
Well, common shell was used for knocking down masonry, anything like that. I mean, the week before the Somme battle started, the night before it actually started, the last thing we did was to knock down Mamet's church and Waterloo chimney by means of common shell. You range with shrapnel first, which gives you a white smoke, you see, easily visible. Well, that was customary, you'd range with shrapnel. And then you use common shell while you're watching through glasses. It's just like a hammer blow. The striking force was about 40 tons. And you just saw the whole corner of the church simply knocked out. And, well, we were not sure whether the Jerrys, if they were any up top, whether they got down in time before we brought the tower down. Because the moment that shot's fired, you see, the gun fired, immediately before the shell arrives at its destination, they're reloading that gun.
From the point of view of the gun crew, what was the differences in their method between, say, firing common shell and firing shrapnel?
Well, common shell has no fuse. It's just a solid lump of steel. The shrapnel shell, the fuse has to be set according to what height you want it to burst or what your range is, you see. The fuse has a ring marked out in tenths of a second. And according to your time of flight, you try to make that shrapnel shell burst just nicely above ground level, because a shrapnel shell consists of, it's like a shotgun, really. The nose of the shell is spigoted into the body of the shell, and it's held by either lead or little wooden rivets. In the bottom, there's a bursting charge. There's a cast iron plate above that. There's a rod goes right through the shell, a hollow tube. And from the fuse, there's a double fuse in the shrapnel shell. There's a taran fuse and a percussion fuse. And the flash from that goes down into the base, ignites the bursting charge. The iron plate pushes the bullets up and forces the nose of the shell off, and then the bullets are all sprayed out of the shell. Like that. Well, if the shell hits the ground first, it's useless.
Yeah.
You did have a percussion field, yeah, but all that happens is that the bullets are just driven in the ground. I mean, I've had shrapnel shell burst alongside me, and no damage at all, practically, gone in the ground.
I know one of the great problems for artillery in 1914 and 15 was the quality of the ammunition was very low. What was it like in 16 when you went
in
over?
In 16, we were having American ammunition, and some of the fuses was very bad. Because before then, we used to get premature bursts quite a lot. In other words, the fuse would ignite, would detonate the shell just outside the gun muzzle, maybe on 100 yards, you see.
That could be a bit hazardous for the gun.
I've never heard anybody get hurt because it's going forward, you see. But when you're wasting your time when a shell bursts with it before it's done 100 yards.
Mm. Was the ammunition faulty in any other ways?
No.
Any other problems you had?
No. Later on, when you're getting enough British ammunition, we didn't have it again. But there again, you get different fuses. The original fuses was the 44 for HE. That has a fifth of a second delay, you see. So it goes in the ground. This is for, you know, blowing up the enemy's wire to send to uproot it, sort of thing. The shrapnels had the fuse was number 88. Well, then later on we got the 106 fuse. That was a shrapnel fuse, but it was to burst on ricochet, you see, up to about 9,000 yards, a 60-pounder lands on its shoulder.
Now, as a signaller, you would be working primarily from forward observation posts, which would be some way in front of the gun sites themselves.
In the trenches, as a rule.
You'd normally be...
Very often we're in the trenches. Sometimes, if you're doing work in, say, a fairly hilly country, you might find better observation from higher ground, even though it's further back. But mostly, your OPs was in the trench. Sometimes, as odd occasions, I've been in no man's land.
Would you make your own sort of dugouts, or would you use the front-line trenches as well?
You'd use the front-line trench. You'd have a little place where the infantry knew you were all right, you see. But occasionally, you'd have a special trench dug for you, what they call a flying trench. Or sometimes, they'd dig you one out in no man's land without any communication to them. You'd have to crawl out there in the morning.
What was a flying trench like?
On its own, you see. In front. You know, no communication with the front line.
Yeah, okay, describe what kind of dugout that would be.
It's just a trench, that's all. Uh-huh. And you sometimes you couldn't see enough from out of your own trench, so you got to go a bit further forward, maybe 100 yards further forward, because no man's land varied from, say, 30 or 40 yards to up to maybe 200 yards in places.
Mm.
And from where you went out like that, you'd get a greater range than if you'd stayed where you were.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, see.
I went to one point, before we one stunt came off, we wanted to neutralise enemy batteries, you see. So what we were doing, we were registering our batteries on his. And we were in no man's land then. There was a bit of a ruin in a farmhouse or something, I think. We were amongst this brickwork, that, you know. And with a periscopic binoculars, if you know what I mean, like two horns. And you had a sandbagging thing that over, and we should get some mustard, there was a lot of mustard going about, tie that onto them, and as it begun to droop a bit, pull it down, fix some more, tie that on, you see, so that there was no drooping things, as you see. If Jerry was watching through powerful glasses and saw some drooping stuff, he'd begin to run, you see, so you got to keep them going all the time. But when you're registering on a battery like that, you've got to be very careful not to let him know that you were... wise to him. So what you'd do, you'd keep a record. You'd maybe drop a shell 400 yards over him and do nothing more until, say, maybe afternoon. You maybe drop one 300 yards short. Maybe 2 days later, you'd drop one at the correct range, but maybe 100 yards to one side. Well, you knew how much the deviation was, so many minutes, like of a degree. You wanted to reach a point when by means of the collections on those ranges you could then score a direct hit, you see. So you'd got to be sure of your distances. We had in our binoculars, we had a degree scale, you see, so that we could measure out how many degrees right or left of a battery the shell was dropping. Well, if it's so many degrees at that distance, the brigade could work out what it was from the battery, you see. So
So when you'd located an enemy gun, you wouldn't necessarily want to knock it out straight away?
No, no, you wait until there's some action coming off, you see. Well, then the Jerrys are deprived of so much artillery support, because we've previously got those guns taped.
Good. Did your equipment enable you to avoid you being seen by the enemy at night? What sort of lights you were using?
Well, we didn't need any lights. You were the telephone, you see.
Mm.
But there wasn't any real observation at night work. Never, because there was no action going on. Only shellfire going constantly. The reason we had to be there at night was because you manned an OP on a 24-hour basis, and you had to get into position during the hours of darkness. Not for fear of being hit, but you mustn't give the position away, mm-hmm. you see. If you'd got an OP, you didn't want the enemy to know where it was.
But you would have to do some work by night, I imagine. How would you light your work? What about siege lights you told me about yesterday?
Oh, that was on the guns themselves, not observation, you see.
Oh, I see. Mm.
That's the aiming point for the guns, you see.
Right.
When you put your guns into position, you take the right-hand gun, A gun, and then you get the others 25 yards from it, in line at 90 degrees. When that gun is at zero position on his sights, the others must be all dead in line at 90 degrees.
Mm.
And then you're in open country. Well, you can see maybe some landmark, and you can take that as a reference point in daytime to do so many degrees right or left of that. But at night time you can't see those, so you must have something within sight of the gun which will give you a base from which to take your anvils.
Mm.
So you put this post in the ground, just a steel rod it was, with a little black and white square on the top and a little bracket on which to put this lamp of a night.
Mm.
And the lamp had a candle in it, and a cover over the glass with just a slit in it, because even then the lamp faced you, not the enemy. And when you were ordered to fire at night, you took your sightings with your dial sight from that slit. But your guns were always ready laid on a particular SOS target of a night in case it was wanted.
Mm.
You had nothing to do but to slam the shells in and start firing.
Now, I know that the artillery barrage for the Somme battle was the biggest barrage of the war to date, and it went on, I think, for a period of 5 days.
7 days.
7 days, yes, yeah.
It was going to be 5 days. Mm. Actually, the advance was put back 2 days, you know.
What are your memories of that 7-day bombardment?
Well, I was at the observation post during the day several times. I think four or five days, I believe, I was at the OP. The OP where we hadn't dug it. The sappers dug it for us on some very hard, chalky ground. And they put fascines, like woven stuff over the top, and put the earth on top, and there's mustard. And there had to be water from underneath, so they not to give the show away. But from that point, we had a pretty good view of a lot of Jerry's stuff, you see. All around the Metz and the bricketry and such as that. And then when the day actually came, I'd been on duty until I think 6 that morning. I'd just come off and just gave me breakfast. And I'm warned that I've got to go report to Brigade Headquarters immediately. And Joe Sumpton, another of my chaps, the two of us went. I wasn't even NCO then. That was on the morning of the 1st of July. So we got up to the Brigade Headquarters, and there was two field artillerymen. We found out later they were drivers, not signallers. And there was a French liaison officer, because we were on the extreme right of the British line, you see. And this French liaison officer, he could speak English, of course, he was sort of hopping with impatience to get going. We had a Lucas E lamp and a battery with flags and a telescope and binoculars and rations, you know, iron rations, a couple of biscuits and a tin of bully and a bottle of water. He marches as fast as ever we could move up to the front line. We just got there about, they were on the scaling ladders already. He gave us some hasty instructions to follow up the infantry, you see, and report progress to this OP, which is a brigade OP, in the on the road behind. And and then, when I could get a word in, I said, "Well, you'll be with us, won't you?" So, he says, "No," he says, "Who's the senior soldier?" Well, all I was. I was 21 later that month. He placed me in charge and cleared off. just like that. Oh, that's the devil. I mean, we're left to do brigade observations. There's two ordinary signals and plus two field artillery drills. We'll talk about Fred Carno's bloody army, that was it. And so, all right, the whistles went and they went over the ladders and that settled. And they went over the top like that, and after time we followed them. I hadn't even bothered them all. And so we got along like that until finally we got news that Monteman was captured. That was the first message I sent through that morning. I think Monteman captured, I think it was 9 a.m, something like that. And we were out all that day. We stuck the flag up towns to send messages through, and we got shelled. At one point, I remember we were on the side of a trench, and I'd got this telescope to read the OP, because we'd got to see if they got the answering, you see. They were getting what we were trying to send through. And I got this telescope propped on an empty round food tin and a bit of cheese rind on the lid so that it didn't roll. I can remember that little detail. And I'm sat like this with this telescope like that, and Joe's sending. He sat on the trench, who didn't dare stand up, you know. We found out later they had this bloody OP in Trones Wood. You see, and we found it a few days later, you know, fortnight later. That's where they were observing from. And suddenly there was a terrific crash behind us, and next thing I know, we're in the bottom of the trench, buried under the side of the trench. But these two RFA blokes are no damn good, so I said, well, you get under cover, keep out of it. And well, they got us out with their hand, you see. And that happened twice that afternoon. Each time, we're a bit mucked up in that, you know, but we're not very deep, anything like that. We've just loosed a few, but it wasn't very pleasant for all that. And then we went further along that day, and there were some parties of Jerry's coming along, coming to us with their hands over. We didn't want them. Go on, bugger off out of here. And so, all right, we went on and on, and night came. Well, we got no orders. We couldn't get anything from this party, so we came in on our own. Well, we had no water, you see, because we had no water left. But about 9 o'clock, we'd all given water to wounded men going back, you see, so we had no water at all. So I said, well, I'll go back and see if I can find some water. So, because I had a sort of a very well-developed sense of direction. If I'd been over anywhere, I could go again. Sort of. And so I went back up towards Delville Wood. No, not Delville Wood. No, that was in Ford. No, what the hell is its name now? Billon Wood, I think. Anyhow, I found a field battery there, and I begged the Sergeant Major, let's have fill these water bottles, you see. So we're on a forward observation about a mile up and more in front. So I got these filled, and then when I got back, there was this officer from the 31st Division Transport. He wanted to get in touch with his men in front, and I tried to get a message through for him, and the next thing I knew, there was a shell burst above, and it knocked the lamp out of my hand, and I'm left with the sending trigger in the hand, and that was the end of the lamp that night. Oh, bloody good job. We can't do any more signalling at night now. So I don't know where we got down during the night, but we were out all that day, the next day, with no more rations. And we set off to come back. We couldn't get in touch with this OP because we're too far out, you see. So we set off to come back, and we picked up a field artillery lad. He got himself lost. I think I don't know what he was doing.
Yeah.
So we tagged on him to come back. You see, it was reasonably quiet, and suddenly they started shelling in this valley. And the next burst, we flung ourselves down. Well, he didn't get down quick enough, I suppose, because when we got up, he didn't get up. It was dark, you know, but not, he couldn't see. And so he's hit. And so we could see a dull glow in this bank. And so I said, go and see if that's a dressing station, you see, and it was. Advanced field post, you see, and we've got a stretcher there. We picked this chap up. But I thought, he feels funny, you know, I picked him up with the legs. Got in charge, oh, good God. The officer, the captain's in charge, he just got a bloody put up. All that was all gone, and the blood was run off the stretcher on my breeches. But I couldn't see that in the dark, of course. Mm. You know, we got back, and that was that. And a fortnight later, the dose was repeated. We had to have another advance for longer than flares, but that night, we massed in that Carnoy Valley. Our brigade has increased from 6 batteries to 20 just for that night. And heavy stuff, 8-inch and 9.2s as well, you know. And I think at 10 o'clock they started, and I'd been on the telephone and listening to all the targets that were given. Each battery was only given, you know, about 50, 60 yards of road. In half a mile of road, you'd 80 guns on half a mile of road. Good God, somebody's got a copy. The road between Longueval and Flares.
That's a hell of a concentration.
It is. And at 10 o'clock, all those guns suddenly started. Gunfire for 3 minutes, and then steady fire after, you see. Well, in the early hours of the morning, I set off with Mr. Simon, Pym Simon, P-Y-M, that was his name, Pym Simon, and three other fellas. There was Locking, Collier, and myself and Charlie Johnson. And we set off on forward observation again, you see. Well, it was a misty, dull morning, thick ground mist, you see. This officer said, oh, it's bloody awful, it wind up proper. We got to into Montauban. There was 27th Infantry Division, a brigade there or something. And he's goes down there to, I don't know what for. Well, we made some audible remarks about officers funking it, you know. But however, he left us. We was a dike alongside the road. There were some fallen trees there. And, you know, give me a shell. It was underneath this dike. A shell hit this tree, split it in half. Nobody got the scratch. And we're covered with pulverised wood. Oh, it wouldn't come off your tunics. Just a yard or two either side, if it missed the tree trunk, it was exploding the dike. We used to have all got it. So we were shut off again. With a delay, by then the advance had got started. We're walking over this open ground, and it's this thick mist is rolling about, and there's bullets flying about, and Locking, a hockey as we used to call him, the chap who said he could ride and found he couldn't. I remember him saying that, well, for stray bullets it's bloody good shooting. And so then we had a voice yelling to us, sort of, get down you silly so-and-sos. So we dropped flat and crawled up, and there was a bank about, I think, 2 foot high. We crawled up to there, and there was some infantry. It was the 8th East Yorks. There was about 200 of them left out of 800, and it was only 20 minutes after the start. They'd lost 75% in machine gun fire like that, and they were pinned down like that. And one chap was making a run behind him, and I remember we were in the shallow then, and this chap, somebody hit him right in the ear like that, and he pitched amongst us like that, and just for a few moments, I suppose his heart was still beating, the blood was spurting out of his ear like that. Then gradually died away. Well, then the next thing was Jerry put a box barrage down, you know, behind like that, to cut him off that section. That means he's going to attack, and he's cutting off reinforcements. So I said to this officer, we'd better get out of this. I said, there'll be a counter-attack in a minute. And he wouldn't move, so you bloody well stay there. I said, I'm going. And so we started crawling out. We had some rations with us, and I had a sandbag with tins of bully on, and I put that across the back of my neck, and we were crawling flat on our faces to get through this barrage. It was shrapnel, fortunately. Most of it's going, wasn't bad. They were going in the earth and not doing much damage. So I'm crawling through these, and suddenly there's a terrific clout on the back of my head, knocked me out for a moment, and then I felt something move, and one of the chaps, what had happened was a big clod of earth, as I'm crawling along, had dropped on the back of my head like that, bashed me, my nose was bleeding, my chin was cut, and we crawled through it, we got out of it like that. And then later in the day, we got an observation post. The officer was gone, we lost him, I don't know where he went to. We started work, and I saw the Deccan Horse go into action. There was a plane. We established another observation point for collecting information, you see, on this slope, and then on the far side we saw some infantry transport come up, you see. There was a lieutenant quartermaster there. He sent across to us after a time, and I went over, and they said, are we off for grub, you see? So I said, well, I've only got biscuits and bully. And so said, you got a bag. He gave us some bread and butter and ration that, and jam and such as that, and tea and sugar. And you know, he's a chap, I think he'd be getting on to 50, lieutenant quartermaster, so not a fighting man at all. He'd brought up all the rations, and he was practically in tears. He said his lad wouldn't need it. You see, thing is, when you lose men, it's a day or two before you can stop the rations coming up. You're a ration strength of so many, and the Army Service Corps in the back, they're setting up that, you see. Even, well, you might have lost half of your men. And what happens to all the group? You live like fighting cocks, so they're just left for a day or two. Well, then another point I saw was this plane, a Morane Saulnier, the French plane that we had at the time, monoplane, kept diving down onto the corner of a field, you know, on our left front. I saw this cavalry coming across. I found out after the Indians, the Deccan Horse, they called them. And this plane was diving down like that, you see, and up again, you see. And suddenly, the officer in charge of the cavalry, he cottoned on. And he stood up in his stirrups, waved his sword above his head, and they just charged like that across that field. The two outer lots split like that, you see, sort of encircled. Next thing we saw, there's 34 Jerry prisons, some of those heavy machine guns. They're waiting while the cavalry got a bit near, by God, they just slaughtered them. But just like that, it just went like that, like the shot out of gun, bats out of hell.
This was British cavalry?
Indians. Indian cavalry, yes, the Deccan Horse. Deccan is a part of India, isn't it? The Deccan Plain, you see, province of that. But I never seen it like it in my life.
And so this was a successful cavalry charge that captured some machine guns?
Yes. Well, I had to do, otherwise they'd all been killed. But I mean, the plane was, I think, trying to draw their attention to the fact that because he couldn't do anything, he'd no arms, you see, just diving down on top. I suppose distracting these machine gunners, because the plane coming down, you know, close above your head, is enough to draw their attention. And as I say, this fella cottoned on and he just stood up and he said, waved his sword out, and it went like that and encircled them. It was all over in a matter of seconds.
That must have been a pretty rare sight on the Western Front.
Then they saw I saw some Jerry prisoners coming back, and this was really terrible. Really. There was about 200 of them, you see, and there was, I think, a score of our chaps, guards, you know, down the side and in front. There's a big German officer leading in front, proper square he was, about 6'2" or 6'3", and he's walking behind this corporal who's leading, and he suddenly grabs his rifle from behind, he's looked down, like that, turned around, I don't know what he held, he's too far away, so he shouted, shouting, you see, to his men. Instantly, all these, our chaps, they just ran about 50 yards away and turned around and started shooting at him. Pretty soon quelled that mutiny. But I mean, a stupid thing to do, really. They were all disarmed.
Okay.
Well, then we got back to the battery. Well, the officer, he sent down when he does get back, for, you know, for ostensibly a course somewhere. He's suffering from, I mean, he always was an excitable, nervous sort. He got into trouble in the race course. I mean, for his horse wouldn't stand still or something, and he kicked it in the belly. By God, imagine, it had killed him. You never treat a horse. That's one of the things in the army. They never allow you to do to treat a horse.
What happened to you after this?
Well, as I say,
this is where you got to.
A day or two later, we went up in the evening to get another observation post. You see, because where we were was out of range. Mr. Noble and Mr. Robbins, and myself went up, and we got through beyond Montauban, and then there's Bernafay Wood on your right front, and we went to Trones Wood. Well, good God, there was no trees intact at all. There just stumps about this height, and tree tops all mixed up together. There was barbed wire up to that height, bodies all over the place, cherries and ours. And Robbins, he pulled some undergrowth about. We were having to fish our way through this, you see. And there was a dead Jerry there, where he was shot away right up his hip like that, and all his guts hanging out, and flies on it, you see. And he just sort of stepped back, and this leg that was up in the tree branch above him, that leg fell across him on his head. Good God, he vomited on the spot. Terrible. So we came out of there, not having no pain here. And that was in the corner there. We saw this concrete emplacement, and that's where he's been observing from when we got buried, you see. It's completely open ground to there. And every time we stuck a flag up, he started shooting at us with these 4.2s. So we got out of that. We're walking across this open ground between Bernafay Wood and Trones Wood, and there's a big trench goes right across it, a big communication trench. And Mr. Robin and Mr. Nobbins, they'd got across there, and I'd stopped to cut some brass buttons off a dead man's tunic, and he won't want them anymore, of his coat. We were getting by then these composition buttons, not plastic, there wasn't plastic, it's just some sort of compo, compressed, and the shank pulled out of them. But awful things. Good brass buttons, I'd love those, and I cut them off, and I've just got these buttons in my pocket, and I heard it. Jerry was harassing fire, you know, odd ones dropping about with 5.9s, you see. And I thought, God, this one's coming close. Well, before I did it, you always mark your cover, you see, the nearest hole to dive into, and so I dived for this trench, you see, and flung myself into that. I flung myself over, there's bodies laid down the fire step. So I landed the bottom of the trench on the haunches, you see. And at that moment, this blubbing shell lands in the corner of the trench. I'd have been better if I'd have stayed on top. Well, the blast blew me out of that trench. I was just getting to my feet, you know, as you go down the note. It blew me out of that trench. I bruised my hip on the edge of the trench as I fell out, I think. And I landed about, you know, two or three bays away. Well, they both dropped at these two officers in front. And I picked myself up. Oh, boy, that's a huge cloud of smoke. Oh, boy, hell, that's bloody lucky. And I started, I said, are you all right? I said, yes. And so I started to walk on after them. No bones broken. In riding school, they taught you to fall soft, you see. And instinctively, you do it. Let everything go slack. And so I walked on a bit, and I felt this hand was wet. So I wiped it on my britches. And I wiped it a second time on my britches. No, no, God, it's blazing, so everything's dry as a bone. It was blubbering off my hands. So I thought, oh, hell. Went to... In there and came out here. So I said, just shouted to, I said, half or more, I am it after all. So we sat down in a hall. I'd got a field dressing, you have a field dressing in the corner of your tunic, you see. Well, being a precautious type, I had two, one in each corner. And they hadn't one, neither of them. So I got one out. And he started bound it round there. I says, I'm all right. He says, that's my arm. I said, no, I said, see here. I didn't know then. I'd got one in here through my jaw. Maybe a faint scar, is there? I think you see, very faint. Mm. And one in the throat here, just Mr. Dougal, about 8 foot in. Another one in the back, which I didn't find out that till I got to the wall about the one in the back, you know.